Roguecast is the official podcast of Rogues Gallery Comics and Games. Every week we talk about new comic releases, store news, and whatever games, movies, and TV is on our pop cultural radar. I'm Randy.
This is Dave.
I'm Nick.
And now, on with the show. Welcome to Roguecast episode 241. I got nothing. It's cold.
It is a little bit chilly in here. Our heater's not working well, so if you could bring us parkas so we'll survive the winter.
Yep.
Do you know it's going to be down in the 20s blankets? Next week, by the way?
I know. You think I'm not aware that what the cold is coming? I'm aware. My nemesis.
But, I don't know. Do we have anything big going on? Is there anything occurring?
No,
we're post-holidays.
So we've got our Ravnica Allegiance pre-releases this weekend.
Yep.
That's Saturday and Sunday. There's still spots in both of those.
Yep. But it's filling up.
Yep. And then starting on Tuesday the 29th, we're going to have a new D&D game. It's not Adventurers League, but it is Guildmaster's Guide to Ravnica. I think there's still spots in that game if you've been wanting to jump into D&D. Also, starting on Tuesday nights, starting as you hear this, we'll have already had the first one, but every couple of weeks we're going to be doing a game night at Easy Tiger.
Yep.
So come out from like 6:30 to 8:30, play some board games. They have beer specials. You can have some of the best pastrami on the planet. Some of their sausages are also amazing. Their pretzels, like, it's a good place.
It's so good that I want it right now, as always.
Yep. Y'all should come out and play games and eat food and drink, and I will be there running games. Then on Monday, February 4th, we'll start our annual inventory sale. Mm-hmm. So we'll be clearing out stuff that is hasn't sold for us in a couple of years, but there's always good stuff in that mix. There'll be stuff we're heartbroken to put on sale.
Yep.
There'll be good board games, good graphic novels, all that kind of stuff.
Yep, you'll see tears in our eyes.
Yes.
And I don't know if we'll have time to, but I'm sure, you know, usually there's ones that are kind of our standouts, like, sadly, no one has bought this, but it's one of my favorites. You should pick it up. So we may make some recommendations on the podcast.
In the podcast, I'm sure you'll hear that. Kate's Final Fantasy card game nights continue. She's going to do that on Sunday, February 10th. And then the Magic the Gathering Ravnica Allegiance weekend is coming up Saturday and Sunday, February 16th and 17th. We don't know much about that yet. We haven't quite figured it out, but it'll be either standard or draft, and there'll be promo cards and that kind of thing. So there's some stuff.
Woo-ha.
There's some stuff. All right. So Nick put a bunch of trailers in our news feed this week.
Hey, just a ton got released.
And so we're going to talk about all those.
But there was only superheroes in, like, one of them, Nick.
It's true.
That's a good thing sometimes.
Two of them, actually. Two of them.
Another two?
Punisher? He's a superhero, right?
Yeah.
His power is guns and murder. So there were four Netflix trailers.
His power is the broken justice system.
Yes. We're going to run them down. First, let's talk about Russian Doll.
Yay. Now, I mean, this one is a kind of a weird series focusing on Natasha Lyonne as we watch her die constantly.
Yeah, it's Groundhog Day.
Yeah, it's Groundhog Day.
With a tumble down a stairwell.
Yeah.
A bad tumble down a stairwell that, like, breaks her neck or whatever.
Yeah, that's how it starts. Before that, there's other ones, too.
Yeah, that's on how it starts. It looks like, and then she learns from that mistake and to not do that again and try other ways to live her life, and then, of course, she dies.
Right.
So, yeah, it looks like there's definitely a larger story.
Netflix series, miniseries?
Yeah, it's a series.
Do we presume a finite one? It seems like that's a kind of a finite story.
I mean, Netflix has shown a tendency to do a second season for everything, so it depends on how it does. But
how
I'm
much
sure,
people like seeing her get killed?
I'm sure it'll depend on how much people like Natasha Lyonne being killed.
So tell me, who's the lead actress?
Natasha Lyonne.
And what's she been in?
She's most Orange recently been Black, Orange is the New Black.
She's been in a ton of stuff, but Orange is the New Black is where from.
She was in a movie called Slums of Beverly Hills that I remember really, really enjoying.
What's her character on Orange is New Black?
She's Nikki.
Yeah.
She's a former drug addict. Like, she's read The Russian Chef. She's like her sort of surrogate daughter.
Mm-hmm.
She's kind of the streetwise, smart-talking, sarcastic one.
Okay.
Yeah, she's great. She's a great character.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm more interested because she's involved. And,
me too.
But
it's a fun trailer.
Well, also, it's made by Amy Poehler,
she's producing it.
Which,
but Amy Poehler's produced some terrible things.
Yeah, but her track record is not awful.
It's definitely mixed.
Yeah, I mean, but her involvement at least makes me interested.
I agree,
I mean, it might not all be winners, but she... I mean, usually
they
I get a laugh.
Can't all be winners.
They can't all be winners.
What would you call it? Dark comedy?
Yes.
Yeah, it's the vibe I got.
And I honestly think they are focusing on the deaths, and that will be the big thing. But I think there's going to be more a story involved.
I mean, I'm sure there is.
And a larger concept at play.
We were talking off mic a little bit about, like, well, you know, like, ground. Generally, these things have an arc, a character arc. You know, usually, simply put, there's kind of a little moral lesson to learn. Bill Murray needs to learn. What does he have to learn? To appreciate his girlfriend in Groundhog Day.
What was his girlfriend?
It was his girlfriend. He basically learned all about her over the many deaths that he.
Okay.
Well, it was more about self-discovery. It was about himself.
He needed to step out of his old ways
or
whatever.
Stop being an asshole.
Yep, and the Happy Death Day, the kind of horror merging with the concept recently, had a sort of, you know, sorority girl who was, you know, kind of the superficial sorority girl, mean girl type, who kind of needed to mature and grow up and discover her killer.
the arc of all...
That classic one.
Yeah, yeah. Isn't that... I think Jane Austen wrote a lot of books about that.
Yes.
So I actually think it would be interesting if there was not that sort of traditional character arc, or if it was approached in a very unusual way, and this looks like it could deliver on that.
Yeah.
Then there was the Punisher Season 2 trailer, which looks like a thing that exists.
Yes, to expound on that a little bit more, it does not look amazing to me.
Yeah. Wow, it doesn't look amazing to you? That's bad, because you're a Punisher fan.
I didn't even finish the first season of Punisher. I watched, like, the first three episodes, and I was like, okay, this is okay.
It punished his viewing. Yeah. I know some people are very into it,
yeah.
And, like, I do expect the writing is you know, kind of a bit of a step up from probably the Punisher movies of the past.
Oh, sure.
But, yeah, as I was watching
there was... Are you besmirching Dolph Lundgren? You're besmirching Dolph Lundgren.
I'll do it if you
Dolph
want.
Lundgren is an amazing man. I guess he might have just stepped into one or two movies that didn't live up to him.
Or 30.
You'd be quiet about Universal Soldier.
Between that and the Expendables, like, I mean, how can we ever doubt him?
Does Dolph Lundgren have any good movies?
He has the Rocky movie. And even Rocky
IV.
He was a monotone robot.
Yeah, where he was.
And
cheesy.
More recently, he was an Aquaman. He was really fun in that.
He was. I mean, he's always playing off his kind of tough guy mystique.
Yeah, of
though.
Course.
But
he's never going to be the lead in a romantic comedy.
I will say there was nothing in this that like felt super compelling. The big thing seems to be pairing up Punisher with a girl he saves.
Yeah.
And kind of. A little bit of a mixed pairing as the two of them, you know, as he goes
like
keeps around a protector,
like, right? Christian society or cult is after her.
I've heard that, although I didn't.
It's not in the trailer.
I mean, they're all wearing like that main guy is wearing like a collar.
Sure, but if I had not known that from anything else, I would not have picked up on it from the trailer.
Yeah.
Well, I suspect this is weird to say, but even that making those the villains, they probably want them to watch the show.
Yeah,
yeah.
Because Punisher has a lot of alt-right fans.
Yeah.
Which is scary.
Yeah.
I, at this point, would kind of like them to retire the Punisher.
By retire, you mean kill.
I would be okay with that,
yeah.
I think. And I also grew up with him as a favorite character, but more and more over the years, he started to feel like the way I think Alan Moore and some of those guys were kind of lensing superheroes in the 80s when they would talk about fascism, and I would be like, I don't even know what fascism is. What are they talking about?
And now you know.
Now I know.
We all do.
You know, it's still a part of all action tropes is
sure.
The hardcore payback, you know, the system didn't work. And I get it. Systems still don't work, so I understand all the reasons behind it.
We wouldn't have Taken and John Wick and all those other things.
And that's the thing. I think Punisher is an action movie concept. It's a bit of a right-wing movie action concept.
Yep.
And I think you and I, Dave, while we loved them in the 80s, have maybe soured on them a little bit.
A little bit.
Also, it looks boring to me.
Right.
Yeah,
well,
and
you
think it's more the bland nature that kind of takes away from me, because even their Jigsaw, which Jigsaw is supposed to look horrific,
right,
is still a pretty boy with a couple of scars on his chin.
Yeah, that was a weird call.
And I'm like, and then he puts on a
mask.
He
looks like he's like Vega in Street Fighter.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and he puts on this cheesy little like paper mask, and I'm like, what? This is not Jigsaw.
Cheesy? No, it's terrifying, like the masks of... What's the crime is legal movies?
Oh, The Purge.
Yeah, he's got a terrifying Purge mask.
No, he doesn't. He's got like a wimpy Purge mask.
Like if you went out wearing the Phantom of the Opera mask.
Yeah,
yeah, I don't think he would instill
fear
a lot of
me.
Fear.
Is Purge Anarchy the second one? Is that the one Frank Grillo?
That was the third.
What was the second one? Purge
2. The Reckoning.
The Purge thing.
I think it was in Purge 2, The Crimes of Grindelwald.
Yeah, yeah, Purge 2. Whatever the second one was where they introduced Frank Gillow's like ex-cop character.
Yes.
That's the best Punisher movie I've seen.
Yes.
Yeah, I agree.
I agree.
Everybody should go out and watch Purge 2.
Yeah.
And then Purge 3. That was a good continuation of his character.
That's right. I forgot
Purge 3 coming to America. I think that's right. Anyway, None of us are huge. Well, that's not true. Nick is a huge Punisher fan, but maybe not of the Netflix Punisher.
No.
Yeah. I know y'all have both enjoyed Punisher comics in the last few years.
Oh, actually, currently. You enjoy the current Punisher book. Yeah.
Yep.
Although I'm with you. I'm on Team Kill Punisher, so.
Yeah.
Can't kill Punisher.
Sure you can. He's just a man.
Could. You know, DC's answer to Punisher Vigilante, I believe, in the final issue, I understand, is killed himself. Yeah. So
spoilers for an 80s comic that nobody's read.
Very doable.
Yeah.
Most notable thing about Vigilante is that he had a pretty cool George Perez-designed costume.
It was a great costume.
It was a very good one. I have a toy of it.
Oh, really?
I do.
Yeah.
They made a toy of...
Yeah,
Vigilante.
These days they made toys of everyone.
When was it? Like in the last few years, or
It was probably early 2000s.
Well, not everyone. I'm still waiting on my D-Man toy.
That's true.
Yeah, that is a holdout. That's a holdout there.
I think I'm pretty safe in saying.
No, actually, don't say that. You never know.
It's gonna be some $80 Comic-Con exclusive.
I mean, just this week, on the shelf, I almost purchased a Grey Gargoyle.
Grey Gargoyle is the craziest thing. That's a villain.
No one knows who Grey Gargoyle is.
Come to me when
Grey Gargoyle is a deep cut.
Yeah, this is a deep cut. I'm saying, come to me when they've done a Grizzly action figure or a Big Wheel figure. Then we will offend everything.
I want an Armadillo.
Armadillo. That's also a good deep cut.
Was Armadillo... No, not... It wasn't Armadillo. It was Porcupine.
Porcupine would also be very
also
cool.
Be pretty...
Yeah. Yeah, think about it. Think about it, licensing. Look into our suggestions quickly.
All right. There's also two movies on Netflix. The first one is Io, which is a sort of post-apocalyptic, Earth's fallen apart.
This is a environmental and, maybe... I don't know if there's, chemical decline to, acid rain and all that stuff.
It looks like a better version of Interstellar.
That's true.
Yeah, yeah. Or a better version... It looked like a version of WALL-E, except instead of a cute robot, it's Anthony Mackie.
Yeah,
but it's a sort of a road trip movie. I mean, the premise seems to be Earth fell into such decline that basically everybody fled it to Jupiter's moon, Io.
Yep.
And
there's one last ship.
Do we actually see cities on Io? Did they show them?
Mm-mm.
No, not really.
It's all sort of sure. Declining and.
It's kind of weird to not show that. I wonder if there's some reveal to it to happen there.
No, they're all dead.
And evacuating the whole planet is a little bit nuts too.
Yeah. But so there's two people left. There's this girl who we didn't recognize, and there's Anthony Mackie, and they have to get to the last launch pad by going through the dangerous zone.
What I liked about this...
I'm going to call it the Cannonball Run of the apocalyptic futures.
I was going to say Midnight Run.
Yeah, that's actually close to what it was.
They're being hunted by Jimmy Serrano, and Jimmy Serrano, and this is Smog.
I was going to say, the thing I
not
liked...
Not the dragon.
The light...
That would have been Smog.
Wow. Okay. The thing I liked about this is that there really is no villain other than, it's man versus
man's
nature.
Hubris.
Yeah, it's man's hubris. But, I mean, that can be fun, and hopefully...
Well, I like survivalist stuff.
Yeah.
And the
visuals...
It's like
Day After Tomorrow. There's no villain there. There's just cold. Weather.
Right. The villain is that sentient wave of cold.
Maybe the...
CG wolves.
Yeah, the CG wolves.
With CG wolves, it sounds like a old-timey...
CG
name.
Wolves here! also in that man's hubris, too. What was I going to say? But their visuals look very good in this. It's a pretty convincing dystopian world in ruins. And I think if the characters have the chemistry, that's kind of going to be what this relies on.
Yeah, of course. And, I mean... We don't know the woman in the...
Will she have the chemistry that Cap had with Anthony Mackie?
That's true.
Anthony Mackie looks like he's playing kind of a sad sack in this one,
yeah,
too.
If this was, if this was Anthony Mackie and Bucky Barnes going across country, I'd be more interested in it.
It's a Netflix movie. I will give it a shot.
Yeah,
I mean,
sure.
It's one of those... It doesn't... I mean, it costs me a monthly fee, but whatever.
I will watch it if everyone else tells me it's good.
I think I'm also in that same spot.
Yep. I will watch it after I watch Bird Box, which I still haven't watched.
It's overrated.
You know, I watched a little bit of Bird Box, and I thought at least it started pretty interestingly.
Yeah, I mean...
I gave it a test drive, and I'm going to finish watching it, so...
Yeah.
The other movie is Velvet Buzzsaw, by the guy who made Nightcrawler, starring Jake Gyllenhaal from Nightcrawler.
Basically, it's the entire cast of Nightcrawler, because Rene Russo and all those people were involved.
See, one of those movie guys, that Scorsese and other people, who's going to always use...
I have not seen Nightcrawler. Nick has. Dave?
It's another one where I kind of did a sampler with it to see if it would be something I wanted to watch, and it looked pretty good, but although there was, his character is kind of so, I don't want to say maybe unrepentantly amoral.
Oh, he's despicable.
That I wasn't sure if I was wanting to plug into it, even though I know it's probably about maybe at least some glimmer of self-awareness.
This is not goody two-shoes Jake Gyllenhaal from Source Code. This is like unrepentant asshole Jake Gyllenhaal. And in this new one, Velvet Buzzsaw, he looks like he's playing kind of in the middle because he's an art critic that has kind of like hoity-toityness.
Right, and is definitely kind of has like, he's like acid-tongued and jaded, jaundiced, whichever one you like.
Jaded, we'll not go jaundiced. With jaded. Jaundiced is like he's yellow.
No, but jaundiced has a metaphorical meaning as well.
It's true.
but anyway, the... let's see what else happens in the trailer. So we see him doing his art critic thing. We see other people in the world of art.
And there's a girl who finds paintings and sculpture and something from a deceased artist.
Right.
They're very disturbing and catches the attention of the art.
It reminds me
world.
Of the old Lovecraft story, Pickman's Model,
where
this guy drew these like creepy emaciated corpses and things like that. And you come to find out that it does seem like this is the ghouls of H.P. Lovecraft's thing. That he's like seemingly literally... I can't remember if he has like a basement that has these ghouls in it and he like feeds them bodies that he gets and then paints, you know, paints them devouring them and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But there's definitely like some elements of that because it's like they say that like some of this red splotch on it is real dried blood.
Yeah,
not
it seems
paint.
Like he may have been painting with blood and little things haunted.
Yeah.
And there's creepy imagery that, you know, may or may not be people's hallucinations or dreams or whatever, but definitely, you know, like paintings coming to life. Yeah.
This trailer took a turn.
Yes.
Because it started out and I was like,
it was a spoof of the artwork.
I was like, oh, quirky art movie, interesting. And then I'm like, oh, no, it's a horror movie.
Yeah.
And also has Toni Collette in it, which...
I like Toni Collette.
From her last horror movie, which was amazing, which was Hereditary.
Yep. I think is going to immediately enter the canon of one of the great horror movies.
It's true.
It seems clear at this point.
But, I mean, this looks like horror, but it also looks like a lot of fun, kind of... Even
so
John
there was
Malkovich
a larger-than-life quality to it. What's-you-call-its character, Jake Gyllenhaal, was kind of... He's a little over-the-top. The portrayal is almost like a slightly turned to 11 version of a snippy sort of critic guy.
Yeah.
And I think... And all the characters were a little larger than life. And I think that looks like it could be fun. It looks like almost like a satirical movie that suddenly bends into horror.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I'm more excited about this one than I think the vast majority of what we're talking about.
Even the man spider?
No, that one I'm...
The man spider of Europe?
But before we get to the man spider of Europe, the other one is a YouTube Originals Weird City, which is from Jordan Peele's like producing.
Yeah.
And somebody else is involved. I can't remember who it is, the two names, but... it looks like a weird sci-fi anthology. Did I see LeVar Burton in there?
Yeah,
LeVar Burton.
LeVar Burton, I thought, was like the standout as the futurism guy in this, like, I don't know, what would you say, like 20 years in the future or something like
that? Or further. It looked
further than that.
But there's a lot of casual, weird future stuff that felt a little Black Mirror-ish.
Yeah, a little Black Mirror was goofy instead of dark.
It's Black Mirror by way of Better Off Ted.
Yeah, I can see that.
And of course, it helps that the guy from Better Off Dead,
who I know is the guy from Timeless, most recently.
Oh, right.
LeVar Burton's giddy enthusiasm for his weird technology and stuff like that was pretty infectious, and I thought that was interesting. Yeah. That said, I commented to Randy as we were watching it that I kind of missed the old visions of the future that weren't all this. Basically, it wasn't all Black Mirror type weird stuff.
You want your Logan's Run?
The like there was like something I almost maybe just more straightforward about the dystopias of the 70s or the humanism of the 60s. You know, the yes, mankind is flawed and we did make the nuclear weapons, but there is possible greatness in us.
Dave, I don't know how anyone can make something with possible greatness right now.
And then there was of course the jetpacks of the and rockets 50s. Of the 30s through 50s.
It's almost like as time has gone on, we've realized the future is less likely to get good.
Yeah, like Blade Runner set the tone, and we're like, oh,
right,
oh.
That seems likely.
Yeah,
I mean, Weird City does look like it to be. It's a more fun than something like Black Mirror.
What was the last fun sci-fi Minority Report? I mean, that was a pretty cool vision.
Pretty bleak too, though.
I mean, it was bleak for that one city where they were.
But it was also like consumerism run wild and a little authoritarian, more than a little authoritarian.
Yeah, pre-crime and its very thought is sort of.
Only in a test market there.
As it portrayed as executed, I should say, it was kind of an action sci-fi movie though. Yeah. So that's why it didn't feel so heavy.
I'm just saying, you had cars going up the side of buildings. That was fun.
That's an interesting reach there, Nick.
There are flying cars in Blade Runner that doesn't make
it a
fun place to live.
There's a cop tracking down bad guys in Blade Runner, and he falls in love.
Yeah. This does have that sort of brightness and humor to it that I think is
in the show. It felt like it felt like some of the almost like so is this the one that's produced by Jordan Peele?
Yes.
Yeah.
Like it had some of those quirk of the some of the larger than life moments of Get Out.
Yeah.
So I think it'll be dark humor, but I think but it did have a certain like yeah, there's an energy to it.
Of the trailers we watched, it's the one I'm most excited about.
Interesting.
Yeah. And that brings us to Spider-Man Far From Home.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which was...
The Man-Spider of Europe.
I've seen people griping that they're like, oh, this reveals that Nick Fury and Spider-Man are still alive after Avengers 4. I wish they'd waited. I'm like, did you really think they weren't going to bring back Spider-Man and Nick Fury?
Is there any chance... I don't follow all the hype stuff. Yeah. Is there any chance this is literally just meant to be set before it?
No.
No, this is after.
Okay.
But someone did make the
joke...
How
do we know?
I mean, I guess I don't know for 100%.
I was just like, there was nothing in there. Obviously, they're not going to reference that. Remember when we beat Thanos? They're not going to mention that in the trailer or whatever.
It would be weird to do it beforehand. But it's possible.
Yeah, I was just wondering if it was possible or like if this is like a known thing, like the producers have said, of course this movie is going to be set afterwards and y'all chill about it.
Well, I saw somebody make the joke that the real twist is that Peter's a clone and Nick Fury's an LMD.
So Peter Parker has a class trip to Europe.
European vacation. Peter Parker's European vacation.
And
it's gonna be better than European vacation, I hope.
It would almost have to be.
I would hope so.
And then of course he doesn't want to put the costume on over there. He looks like he's even not wanting to take it.
He doesn't take it.
It looks like he doesn't take it.
He closes it and then he's just standing there thinking like it looks like he's ruminating.
It's a new costume
in a new one.
Yeah, it's black, it's got the web wings. Yeah.
Oh, well, I thought I assumed that showed up at some point, but you also see the regular costume, too.
At the beginning.
At the beginning, when he's in New York.
Oh.
Yeah, when
he leaves. So he's going to be like, Nick Fury's going to say, like, here's your Black Ops costume?
Yeah, I think it's possible.
And then Dave's interest plummeted.
I don't know if the mic could pick up me going,
I think the thing is, Dave, you and I have the same issues with Spider-Man Homecoming in that... Both of us were like, this really isn't our Spider-Man.
They're proceeding forward from a premise that I don't like.
Yeah.
But they're doing it very super competently with a lot of wit and character and it's very good at being that version of Spider-Man.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
I can't deny it.
It is the ultimate Spider-Man in a lot of ways. It is...
it's a better version of Ultimate Spider-Man.
I don't know if I agree with that. Ultimate Spider-Man, when it first started, was pretty great.
Yeah, it didn't quickly go downhill, but it was...
It was five or six trades in before it started to decline.
Yeah.
I mean, granted, they had introduced Geldof by that point, but... I think the notion that Nick Fury comes and recruits him, I think it's a fun idea. That actually plays into the Spider-Man that I liked, which is in, like, the 80s when, like, the Spider-Man Wolverine that Priest wrote, where Spidey sort of runs up against the more grown-up morality that Wolverine represents and has to sort of fit his heroic morality into it. I always liked that kind of thing. But, yeah, him as a kid being recruited by S.H.I.E.L.D. is weird. It's a little weirds me out that Peter goes back and forth on whether or not he wants to be Spider-Man. Like, Homecoming was all about how much he wanted to be Spider-Man, and now he doesn't want to be Spider-Man?
Well, something I don't think
he wants
think
to
he
chill
wants,
with his friends, I guess.
I don't think he is not wanting to be Spider-Man. I think he just needs a break. And I understand that if it takes place after him coming back to life.
Sure, yeah.
Him just wanting to sort of go on a vacation with his friends and possibly Aunt May, I don't know.
I don't think Aunt May's going. I think she's in the other
party. Yeah. I understand him wanting to get away and have some fun as opposed to facing off against a world-ending threat.
As with Homecoming, I think what interests me most about this is the character stuff. Like, I like his best buddy Ned. I like their MJ. I love the stuff with Aunt May and Happy at the beginning.
Jonathan Favreau, I think, makes anything he's in better.
Generally, I think that's probably true.
He's just a fun guy.
But I like all that stuff. It's just when the superhero stuff starts, I'm like, I don't know. I don't know if I feel this as much. I like Spidey in the Marvel Cinematic Universe as a member of the ensemble, and the solo stuff hasn't worked for me as much.
Well, Infinity War made him an Avenger. I mean, Tony made him one. Yeah. So
this has a slightly odd thing in that there's usually kind of a driving villain in a movie, and here they only kind of hint at the villain, or they show him, but they kind of don't really, like, if you don't know what's going on, you don't know what's going on.
Yeah.
Because sure. Longtime fans will know that's Mysterio in there.
By the way, they made his costume look cool as hell.
Yeah,
they did. Mysterio. Although, it was weird to me to see him with Jake Gyllenhaal's face at first, and I, watching on my phone the first time, was like, I don't know what I just saw there.
That's because you watched on your phone.
I saw a little purple and green man that was Jake Gyllenhaal, and was not obviously Mysterio to me. Because first of all,
judging you.
The like Mysterio is almost never helmetless, and so having him helmetless in the first shot of him was kind of weird. But clearly, he's being portrayed like building himself up as a hero. You see the other kids like Flash Thompson doing the hero worship thing.
No, Flash Thompson specifically does not.
Oh, that's right. That's right. It's the other kids who are digging him, and he's not. Nah, Spider-Man's the best.
I think they're like saying he's Iron Man and Thor wrapped up in one.
And the bit with the their Flash Thompson I really like because he is a realistic type bully. He's not. He's not even the old school Flash like give me your lunch money bully. He's just kind of a. He just kind of negs Peter.
Yeah.
And that feels more like actual bullying to me, which, Dave, you and I are always complaining about how bullies in fiction are always presented as these...
Give me your lunch money. Yeah. And I'm like, that is like a 50s bully. Yeah. Like, I know that happens, but it never happens the way they show it.
Flash feels like the exact bully you would get at, like, a magnet school for smart kids.
Right.
He's obnoxious about his smartness, and he's maybe not as smart as he thinks he is.
Right.
But I did love the juxtaposition that Stan Lee and Jerry Conway introduced, the whole thing that Flash loves Spider-Man and hates Peter Parker.
Yep.
And
that was an ingenious idea, yeah.
I thought his whole hero worship of Spidey, and then he's like, what's up, dick? to Peter, and Peter's response, because Peter knows he's Spider-Man.
Yeah.
I like that little bit. So there are lots of little bits in here I like. I think, ultimately, I'm not going to like this as well. I'm going to like this about as well as I liked Homecoming, which is to say... I liked it. It grew on me over time, but I don't love it as well as everybody else loves it.
Nick, you looking forward to?
Yeah, very much so. Homecoming is still one of my favorite Spider-Man things. I know it's a departure from traditional Spider-Man, but it was a departure that worked for me.
You okay with Fury being like his shepherd?
Yeah, because, I mean, this isn't the comic book Spider-Man. And, well, I mean...
Maybe he should shoot lasers, too. That's not the comic book Spider-Man. Is that what you'll accept?
How about heat claws? Oh, wait. No, that's a comic book thing, man.
Yeah. So, I mean, the notion of Spider-Man, who is now an Avenger working for Fury, I have no issue with it.
I should hate that, but it doesn't bother me.
Because it works in the MCU.
Yeah.
I would kind of cringe at it in, like, Marvel comics.
Yeah.
But in the MCU, it works because...
For the same reason it worked for me in the Ultimates, too. It feels like it fits that world.
Yeah.
Is this the first time he's used the web wings type thing?
No, he used them
a little bit in Homecoming.
He used them when he was jumping from the Washington Monument.
Okay, okay.
But not to this extent.
No, not to this extent. Second.
Like,
yeah.
He didn't seem really gliding. So, I'm curious, do we all have a different favorite Spider-Man movie? Because Nick is yours Homecoming?
Yeah.
And Dave's is Spider-Man 1?
Maybe so, yeah. The ye old Tobey Maguire ones.
And mine is definitely Into the Spider-Verse.
Yeah. Interesting.
Spider-Man like Batman is very very interpretable, I think.
Yeah.
I actually don't think he is, which is why mine is the Tobey Maguire one, which I feel is closest.
I thought he was even saying why mine is the only logical
one that makes sense.
Yeah, no, there's departures all over the place in the Tobey Maguire one too.
He never talks.
He does a little bit.
I'm still mad about
that. A little bit.
The no quipping really pisses me off.
18 years later, yep. And he's like,
I'm still mad about it.
I mean, if he ran up against into Sam Raimi on the street, I'm sure he would mention.
I would. I'd be like, hey. Why doesn't Spider-Man quip? And he'd be like, who are you? Let me go.
No, why doesn't Spider-Man quip?
but clearly, on a commercial level, he is very open to... not very open to interpretation, because in many ways, these have all... Well, like, Into Spider-Verse is really Miles' story.
It is.
And not Peter's.
But there's a lot of Peter in there.
Yeah, it's true.
I feel like Tom Holland has nailed a version of Peter that kind of... collects all the different versions into a sort of an amalgamation.
He's the young version. He's the ultimate version in a lot of ways.
Yeah, but he's still very quippy. He's fun.
Yeah.
He doesn't have, like, the downtrodden Parker luck.
Right. That's one of the things that's a little weird about it to me. I think a friend of mine was like, Pete was the guy who would, like, kind of go and sort of, like, read books and stuff like that, not the guy who hangs out and builds Lego stuff.
Yeah, that's fair.
That's certainly not the traditional version of him in the past.
Right, that's been kind of updated. He's the techie guy. That's a fairly recent thing, and I like that change because it never made a lot of sense to me that Peter was so smart and couldn't manage to get something going.
But, I mean, they mentioned some of that in Homecoming where he's, like, trying to find bargain, like, computers and things like that. It's
right,
not like,
right.
He's not, like, the I have everything handed to me in my life. There's still a little bit of that.
They do the thing where basically he has to give up his personal life to be Spider-Man.
Yep.
I mean, they did get that trope in there.
Yeah, generally those tropes kind of make their way through in all of them.
Yeah.
And also this
But
is
only a... my favorite Spider-Man movie has Uncle Ben.
That's true. We got to see Uncle Ben die in yours.
Yep.
Well, I mean, I'm kind of glad we don't see that. I mean, it's definitely made an impression on Tom
Holland. Glad he's dead.
I'm glad he's dead.
No, but I mean, it's there. I mean,
right.
Even in the reference to Ben in this, that his luggage, he's using Uncle Ben's luggage.
Oh, all right. I have to ask credit. I have to take some debate with this.
Yeah.
Is Ben really there, or is Tony Stark really kind of taking that role?
I mean, Tony Stark's alive.
Who's he learning responsibility from?
Uncle Ben. We just didn't see it.
Yeah.
Okay.
The Uncle Ben stuff happened. I mean, it's definitely...
He references in Civil War.
Yeah.
When he talks about, he says, if you don't stop the bad stuff from happening, sometimes it's your fault.
Yeah.
That's the only reference we get, because we didn't need to see the origin done again.
That's still canon. Right.
Yeah, I guess I would say I didn't feel it in those ones, but he's still the good kid.
Yep.
Something about, I think, showing the Uncle Ben thing for early on really does, it's almost like the Bruce Wayne parents thing is like, yeah, it's a cliche because they've done so many in such a short span of time, but I sort of do feel, in a way, it's kind of necessary to understand how much responsibility hangs over Peter.
I guess I never want to see Uncle Ben or the Waynes or Krypton die again.
Right, but it's because we've seen it so often and they shouldn't be retelling it so often.
Well, because it's like, everybody knows the story.
Yeah.
There are certain almost like, things like Sherlock Holmes that have fallen into common use. The origin of Spider-Man has fallen into, people know the origin of Spider-Man. Even kids know the origin of Spider-Man. They'll see it somewhere.
Yeah, but to them, he's just a character they play in an app where they like the Venom skin on him, and...
what are you, an old man?
I'm just saying.
What was that?
Kids are into the powers and stuff.
You aged like 30 years.
Just in that one sentence.
I've seen him. Ask the kids in the store. You'll find out.
These kids with their apps and their Deadpools.
And also, I mean, this is the first trailer. They're obviously not spoiling everything, there's definitely going to be stuff that's fallout from Infinity War.
I'd like to not see another trailer, but we will. I like the idea of Marvel doing one trailer for each movie and then being done.
Yeah, I mean, I did feel like you, in their way, they showed you a fair amount with this one. What was the other trailer I saw recently where... I kind of like trailers that feel like they take you on a little bit of a ride, they preview what's going to happen, and then they pull off they before they show you the big climactic moments.
Right.
They don't tell you what the serious crux of it is going to be,
or the whole arc for that matter.
Yeah.
I'm just saying there are going to be some swerves, and I'm looking forward to it.
All right. So, other movie news: Venom 2 has been officially announced. Same director, same writer, I think.
Yep. And also the fact that we are going to get our Carnage by way of Woody Harrelson.
You say our Carnage. He's your Carnage. You can have it.
I don't know. Woody Harrelson.
Did you just age 30 years?
Woody Harrelson is Woody Harrelson is Carnage. I mean,
I think he's gonna have a blast.
He's gonna have a blast.
Yeah.
I actually hadn't, for some reason, I think I thought about this before, but the fact that it's the director of Zombieland, I forgot. That's also
Woody Harrelson. Makes perfect sense.
I don't know if they were buddies from back then or what, but. I'm weirdly more interested in this than I am in Spider-Man's European Vacation. Precisely because Venom wasn't a character I was seriously attached to, and I thought they had fun with him in the previous one. We were just talking about it with Anna earlier, who she liked it as well. And, as long as
Randy say, oh, I should probably watch this based on what you're saying.
I expect that I will enjoy it in the same way I enjoyed Deadpool.
I feel like Woody Harrelson will get to chew up scenery in his natural born killer style, and
I hope he plays it like Larry Flint.
I can see it. That's if the same creative team is making it, I'll probably catch it.
Yeah, I actually make a point to go see it in theaters.
I'm not a fan of Carnage, but I figure they'll probably find something fun to do with him.
Yeah, actually, I mean, he makes sense as a villain. If you don't have Spider-Man, Carnage makes sense as a villain for Venom.
Yeah. At the end of the thing, I mean, this is the cheesiness level when he's like in prison. Woody Harrelson says something like, he's like, because when I get out of here, it's gonna be carnage. It's so goofy.
Ham-fisted delivery makes it. I mean,
yeah, it's because he has an evil gleam in his eye.
Of course.
Yes.
As only Woody Harrelson can do.
Yeah. That's actually Woody Harrelson.
Poor innocent Woody from Cheers grew up to become Carnage.
I know.
all right. Christopher McQuarrie, who did Mission Impossible Rogue Nation and Fallout, has just signed on to direct back-to-back Mission Impossible 7 and 8.
Yep.
Which is pretty cool because he's got the through line. Like, I would have loved to have seen Brad Bird or J.J. Abrams do more based on what they did with 3 or 4, but I think they came in, kickstarted it, and McQuarrie has settled into doing sort of a solid... He's got the formula down.
Yeah, and if he's shooting it back-to-back, I mean, it seems like that's going to be a carryover story like you did with Rogue Nation. And...
Yeah.
I'm less interested in that, I have to
really?
Say. Yeah, I was kind of lukewarm on the last one the more I've turned it over in my head.
Really?
More action and a little bit less away from the big spy heisty stuff. So, and also, I guess in some ways it was luck that they had, it's not some careful choosing, but since John Woo, they had had, four directors in a row doing the original plan of a different director with each movie.
Three.
Was it three?
Yeah.
Brad Bird, McQuarrie, J.J. Abrams?
That's it. Those are three.
Is that it? Okay. Yeah. Oh, that's right. And McQuarrie did the other one. I guess in my head I'm probably thinking of original guy... Who's the original director?
Brian something. I don't remember.
Dennehy.
Brian Dennehy. But he did direct a movie with Brian Dennehy, I think. I can't remember.
Why am I
Brian De Palma.
That?
That's
De Palma.
That's why Polanski was stuck in my head.
Yeah, Brian De Palma.
Anyway, yeah. So, I don't know. There's obviously more action directors out there they could pick. Hell, Jordan Peele could go and make one, and I would watch it.
I would be disappointed if Jordan Peele. I love Mission Impossible. There's no way Jordan Peele should make that.
Well, that was a random example. No, my point is just that, like, I think I would rather to continuing that different voices thing.
I mean, I understand that. I think I like McQuarrie's voice for Mission Impossible.
I do too. I mean, don't get me wrong. Like I said, I would love to see more along the lines of Ghost Protocol, which is a damn near perfect action movie. But Rogue Nation, it was a great follow-up to a really hard movie to follow up. And Fallout has a lot of great scenes in it, and it's got a convoluted plot, but that's become sort of the notion of Mission Impossible.
Yeah, but I don't think he's going to continue that plot. That plot's done.
Yeah, but I mean, he does tend to convoluted planning.
Yeah.
If you ask me what the story of Rogue Nation or Fallout is, I'd have a hard time explaining it to you. Whereas with, like, Ghost Protocol, it's a pretty straightforward story.
Yeah.
Even if the last act is a little shaky. I think none of the Mission Impossible movies have been perfect, but they've all been solid action movies, and McQuarrie did a great job, and I'm looking forward to the
new
one.
Jon Favreau could make a cool Mission Impossible.
I'm sure he could. I don't want to do that. I want to do Star Wars.
Yeah.
That's what he's doing.
Is that what he's doing?
He's doing the Star Wars TV show.
This is a what-if scenario, not a realistic scenario.
Dave,
David Lynch should do a
We look at things and see how they are. You look at things and see how they could be.
How they should be.
You're a futurist.
Yes.
An old man futurist?
You have to be an old man to be a futurist.
I guess that's true.
There are no young futurists. Speaking of old men, Stellan Skarsgård is going to play Baron Harkonnen in Dune.
And he's the villain, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, sounds like a good casting. Yeah, the Baron isn't particularly despicable, but very clever manipulator of people in it. He is grossly fat.
Yep.
You know, that is the...
I don't...
Have you never seen Lynch's Dune?
No.
Oh, really?
Oh. Yeah, he is, like, actually
Did you remember last time I said I know nothing of Dune?
He is morbidly obese
yeah.
and actually has, like, little anti-grav things on, like, his belt or something like that so that he can kind of hover around.
So are they going to CGI a bunch of weight onto Stellan Skarsgård?
That'd be my guess.
Stellan Skarsgård is, like, rail thin.
Or is he going to eat a whole lot of cheeseburgers between now and then?
I mean, that's possible.
I don't know that they're going to point to this, but if memory serves, he's, like, also, like, a pedophile, too. Like,
yeah.
He is a creepy... pustule like
he's awful
pustule guy face dude in all respect but he's also supposed to be a like again a very canny fascist type guy
yeah.
who like really knows how to work Game of Thrones type politics.
When was the last time Stellan Skarsgård played a bad guy? Was it Ronan?
It might have been. I don't know.
That?
Yeah, he was he was like the main villain.
I need to rewatch Ronan.
Ronan's great.
Finally, we have a bunch of Star Trek news. Which I'm sure Dave is already tired of discussing because he's been on Tech Trek.
You know, some of these things have been announced, and it's like Fathery will put out a video where he kind of does the quick responses, but we don't have time to get together for to do a full video. So a lot of times I actually haven't really discussed them yet.
So what do we got?
So first of all, they've said that there's a new animated series in development alongside the Lower Decks. We don't know much about it. Like, we don't know anything about it.
Right.
And then they said that Picard's life has been altered by the events of Star Trek Nemesis and the Star Trek movie of 2009, where they blew up Romulus. So maybe
right.
he's not the ambassador that he seemed to be. Like, maybe they've changed that.
Right, yeah. Like, I guess... what was the... So they're talking about, yeah, the events of the... For when I was thinking of Nemesis, which had the...
Well, it is... Because at the end, Nemesis becomes an ambassador, right?
Yes.
I think that's correct.
I actually do not recall.
Because that was
I've never seen Nemesis. I was just going off
that the was article. After the Borg stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. I was thinking of the in the 2009 movie where the... What is it? Where it gets destroyed.
Yeah.
And the you know, this will, I guess, follow up on that.
Yeah.
So it's interesting that they're taking that in continuity, even though that forces them to acknowledge, unfortunately, J.J. Abrams' ridiculous red matter, whatever it was, thing that made no sense.
But it's also interesting that that means that the Next Generation is going to be affected by all the changes that were made in the Star Trek.
Actually, I don't think that is the case.
Well, Picard's from Next Generation. How is it not?
Well, let's see. Because, like Disco is not set in the Abrams-verse.
Right.
I think that created a separate continuity, essentially. That was the whole point of the 2009 things, is that...
parallel.
Yeah, like, I think Spock, like, essentially, he went back into... and ended up in, like... Was the idea that, like, Nero, right? That's the big guy.
Yeah, it was Nero.
That he, like, essentially crossed over into another timeline or something? Right. I think that's what it was. It generated a new timeline when he went back, so it will not be affecting the mainline.
But if it's not affecting it, how is it affecting Picard?
Because the event that caused it was the destruction of a planet that did happen.
Oh, the Romulus thing did happen, and that's right.
Yeah,
that's
that was
right.
Not like part of like a you know, the time
sense.
Traveling
okay,
stuff.
Okay, good. Okay.
So yeah, what that means is that I think, yeah, who knows? For all I know, he could be like he had left. I've been away from Starfleet for 20 years, and you know I'm a you know my own operator now. Or
maybe he was an ambassador on Romulus, and now he's like, well, I guess I'll go back and be an admiral again.
Could be. Yeah, it only means that they're taking that history into account, and it sounds like, you know, that was sort of portrayed as Spock's big failure, old man Spock, in the 2009 movies. So I wouldn't think it would necessarily weigh on Picard unless they are going to indicate that he had something, you know, he was trying to help Spock or whatever make this happen. And
or Picard is like, I had the off switch and I was in the bathroom, and sorry about that.
I was eating a baguette.
Eating a baguette in the bathroom and then Romulus blew up.
Maybe weird, but I do it.
Well, the only thing here is...
That's what the Friends of the Future do.
Whatever story this is going to be, Patrick Stewart is going to act the hell out of it.
Yep.
I mean, he's great as Picard, and I feel like that's the price of admission for me. I will watch anything that Patrick Stewart
The only
does.
Thing that makes me a little concerned is, like, Patrick Stewart, you know, like, he's been... I think he probably bristled a little under the stodginess of Picard because he himself is a pretty outgoing, exuberant person.
Yeah,
he is that Shakespearean actor, but he also loves to do subversive stuff, messed up comedy and things like that.
He wanted to do Transmetropolitan. He wanted to be Spider Jerusalem.
He is in a way like kind of more countercultural than Picard ever would be.
Oh, yeah.
So knowing that he has like a sort of a strong role in this, or like a creative
producing
voice role, in it, I'm a little worried that he might be like, you know, Picard has become a political agitator in the future, and, you know, and like, it could be one of those things where, you know, like Harlan Ellison wrote a great script for City on the Edge of Forever, but it had, like, the drug use on the Enterprise, which incites the incident, and Roddenberry's like, that's not really a thing that's going to happen on the Enterprise that I'm writing.
Yeah.
And you're like, it was a good original script, but Roddenberry is right, that was not a fit for Star Trek. So there's some nervousness on my part about that, just like, Picard, I mean, the actor Patrick Stewart, he may just want to do something that's a fun role and not worry too much about how it fit in with everything else.
You think maybe he's going to be like, and Picard in this, he has his own ship and many beautiful women around him.
Yes.
But I feel, I mean, aren't...
It's too late. He's already seen it all.
Aren't Orky and Kurtzman, aren't they kind of showrunning all of the Star Trek things for CBS All Access at this point?
They're involved, but who knows who's showrunning?
Because I would feel like they would come up with some guidelines that, like, all the shows at least had to follow, sort of like a Bible.
But there's the argument that Orky and Kurtzman do not understand Star Trek.
I mean, yeah, you could say that, but I mean, Discovery doesn't show it. I mean,
you know what Fathery was telling me?
Discovery has its people who don't think it's Star Trek. Star Trek 2009 has people who don't think.
Right. Fathery was telling me that Kurtzman had based on interviews he'd read with him. That, you know, Father, I don't think he felt like he was the right guy to helm Trek either.
Right.
But that apparently he had kind of like a big soul-searching thing and kind of fell into like a depression over the events of the last few years. And kind of fell in love more with the classic Trek, I think, and that felt like that its voice kind of needed to be heard now.
Okay.
So he may have like, I don't know if that means that he changed in any creative way, but like as a person it seems like he may have gotten more on board classic Trek than you would have guessed from the 2009 movies.
Oh, yeah.
Good. The last bit of...
By the way, jumping back real quick to the cartoon thing. Yeah. I think that's the cartoon they have said is going to be an all-ages one.
So the story I read said that they were talking about also doing an all-ages cartoon.
I think...
But is it this one?
I think this is.
Because the story was poorly written. There's not a lot of information. And it sounded like maybe that they were like, oh, and they're open to other all-ages cartoons. I'm like, does that mean this one's an all-ages, or are we jumping to conclusions?
Yeah.
I'm going to just be a return back to the original animated series.
I do think that like they will probably make it somewhat... this will be a somewhat more action-oriented cartoon. Mm-hmm. Hopefully looking at some of the best of like the Star Wars cartoons of the last 10 years.
Yeah.
I'm nervous from all of these things a little bit. Like, Picard is the one I'm least nervous about, because I do think, like you were saying, Nick, Patrick Stewart will bring a whole, I mean, vast amounts to the role. But there's, like, sort of so many projects happening so quickly that I'm like, are these all going to be good? You know, if they don't like it, are they just going to flush them, you know?
Well, I was telling Randy off mic that are we getting to the point where Star Wars, this is going to have the same sort of Star Wars effect where they're doing too much and they're going to have to cut a bunch of this? Because there's five Star Trek.
It's a sort of unique situation in the sense that it's created as the showrunner for CBS All Access, the same way the superhero shows are for CW. So CW, you could argue that they have too many superhero shows going on, but they've definitely, they all hang together, you
it's
know?
True.
And
you're just saying
so,
five Star Trek shows all happening all at once.
Yeah, from zero to five
lot.
Is a lot in like the span of a couple, 2-3 years.
That said, it's not like Paramount doesn't have a ton of resources to throw out. As long as there's not one person trying to keep up with all of it,
yeah,
you could have six different creative teams working on six different things and it doesn't have any.
I agree.
And I suspect some of these will be like somewhat finite. Like, you know, that one of these animated things could end up, like, obviously if they super take off, they probably wouldn't abandon it.
Right.
But if it's, you know, got a solid following but not a huge one, I could see them doing a single season of the Lower Decks or whatever.
Sure. I would want another animated series, like, focused on something not the Federation. Like, do a Klingon cartoon.
Klingon babies.
I think people are expecting maybe more of a Starfleet Academy one for the all-ages one.
Interesting.
Since they've never quite gotten around to doing that.
Yeah.
But yeah, I wouldn't mind seeing some of those other areas, or just more of a cultural mixing where it's like, you know, something set in a place where Klingons, Romulans, and humans interact regularly, so you see a lot of those other races.
Harry Mudd's brothel.
I'm in.
All ages.
And
the last bit is the thing which I think many people, including Dave, are very skeptical of, which is the Giorgio Section 31 with... Michelle Yeoh is officially in development now.
Right. Skeptical only based on what I would assume the premise would be, which is Section 31 was... so I don't actually know a lot about this because, as Father has told me, I think it only got either one or a handful of mentions in Deep Space Nine.
Right.
Like, I don't think they originally intended it to be some big thing, but it was a secretive organization, sort of a Black Opsy CIA type thing dedicated to sort of... creating stability, but outside of the Federation. You know, it was not supposed to be the Federation covertly approves of this.
This is like Captain America bringing Wolverine on to do all the killing
for
him?
A little bit.
Yeah.
And so, while I thought it was in Discovery, having, you know, this... basically, the baddest chick in the Mirror Universe brought inducted into it made a ton of sense.
Yeah.
But creating a series about it is sort of like having a Star Trek CIA Black Ops series.
Yeah.
And...
unless it's all about the how dangerous they are,
right? Well, yeah, the immediate thing I was envisioning was, you know, Emperor Georgiou is super dangerous person and used to the most ruthless of ruthless things.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought it would be interesting if over the course of a season or so, if she, you know, starts to see that maybe this is not the way things should be done. You know, if there is some part of her that is like. Sees the fruitlessness of it. That's essentially the change that Spock underwent in the original Mirror Universe thing. Kirk kind of approached him on a logical level and said, plot out how long this empire that the Federation is, or the Terran Empire, how long it's going to last. And he's like, you know, it'll be 80.5 years or whatever.
Yeah.
And he's like, think of all the waste that this generates. And he kind of logically talked him into trying to do a better thing.
Yeah.
Now, somebody as ruthless as Georgiou seems less likely to be that person, but I would be interested if my co-podcaster also wondered if there would be like a Suicide Squad style thing where there's like a Rick Flag straight arrow kind of trying to keep things reined in.
Right.
But I would love it if the series subverted itself and had them ultimately trying to bring it down or something like that or sabotage it.
Yeah. We'll see. I don't care because I like I like her.
Yeah,
I like her playing that character.
Michelle Yeoh's amazing.
I am right. Totally.
And we don't even know what the nature of what they're going to be doing is. Like, there's so little know about this that I can't actually get too nervous about it. And I do have some excitement to see more of Michelle Yeoh.
Well, another thing is you are attached to the Star Trek universe in a way that I am not.
Right.
In the same way that I'm like super attached to the MCU right. and have my own vision.
You would be all into Harry Mudd's brothel.
Right.
And I'm like, well, maybe that's not the most Star Trek right. optimistic future of them all.
Right. Right. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, that's
actually you should be a sex positive brothel. Yes. Maybe it should be
Harry Mudd's brothel for kids.
maybe rethink that title.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we could probably let's workshop that. All right. We'll be back in a minute with comics for the week.
One familiar cry. Rocast.
We're talking comics for the week of Wednesday, January 16th. And I'm going to kick off with Conan the Barbarian number 2, which we all really liked Conan the Barbarian number 1. I was kind of surprised how much I liked Conan number 1 because I kind of thought I was done with Conan, but... It turns out that Jason Aaron's sort of original stories he's doing, I really like. Mahmoud Azraq's art is really good. And the second issue is really good. I wasn't sure what issue 2 was going to look like.
It does continue the first...
Well, that's the thing. I thought maybe he might pick up, because the first one it has King Conan and introduces this witch and all that kind of stuff. No, this is a standalone story in a lot of ways.
Okay.
This is a story of Conan out amongst another barbarian tribe called the Picts. Yep. Who have a war going on with the Sumerians, basically, that they hate each other, and he's been murdering them for years.
I was gonna say murdering and collecting heads.
Yeah,
Conan has.
Yes, and so Conan runs afoul while hunting these picks of these giant ghost snakes that are hunting the village, and he winds up basically helping the village against these ghost snakes. So he's working with his enemies and starts begrudging respect developing and that kind of thing. And it's a good story about Conan and what he represents and what his barbarism is good for. And then there's a little tease at the end of the of something that ties into the arc. So it seems like what Aaron is going to be doing is standalone stories with an overarching thread.
Because I forget how this what works in the comics, are the Picts people of color in this?
They're sort of sort of like a jungle tribe, yeah.
Okay. Cuz you know, there's a lot of that kind of stuff in pulp novels. Like, they were racists.
Yep.
and even forward-thinking people would just casually have, like, yes, barbaric African tribesmen. What this strikes me, just because I have not read it yet, but just from what you're saying, and even in some of the comics I read, the Marvel comics I read in the 80s, there were, like, elements of this, is a somewhat more nuanced take on that. Like all right, let's acknowledge that even though, yes, we're not going to say that Conan never, like, was a mercenary who hunted these guys, we need to like have that so that that's not all that happens, you know. We need to go a little bit deeper, and that sounds like an interesting way to do that without like it doesn't seem like to me like they're kind of trying to wipe out his antagonism with them.
So let me give you the line. Jason Aaron has a ton of great lines in here. After Tusculan, Conan swore he would claim the head of 17 Picts in honor of his fallen comrades, one of which had been a dog.
I like the specificity of 17.
Yeah.
That's a nice
and
one.
And then it's like, but that was many heads ago.
Pretty good.
It's really good. It does everything you want Conan to do.
But it also does have some connective tissue to the previous issue's story and kind of things like that. So
just wondering, because like the witch like threatened, you know, was like, I will be back for you.
Well,
but it wasn't like, I'm going to be back for you next issue. It was like, my specter will hang over you.
Well, the implication was that he dies when he's King Conan.
Yep. Right.
And that we're going to see his death. So we'll see how that goes, or if he will avoid his fate or not. Dave, what you got?
Is this a miniseries or series, Randy?
I believe it's a series, but everything's a miniseries now.
All right, sure. So there's a new Invaders comic. I don't have super strong affinity for Marvel's Invaders, and I guess I should say Marvel's Invaders, and it's not just Invaders from Mars or something. So this is their World War II heroes. So that's Captain America, Namor, Bucky, and the original Human Torch.
Yep.
And this is a kind of a fairly gritty kickoff to the series, written by Chip Zdarsky, who was did we talk about Chip last week?
He's slowly becoming like a mainstream Marvel writer.
Yeah, because this is like nothing like any of the other stuff I've read from him. Not his crazy Canadian comics, not his lighter Spider-Man stuff, but where he started getting into somewhat darker material.
Yeah.
And the basic premise of this is that the invaders in modern times, most of whom are like Cap's alive because he was frozen. The Human Torch robot is alive because he's an android. Bucky's alive because of time stuff, tweak stuff.
Is Namor?
Namor's immortal-ish.
That was going to be my question. Has he always been sort of immortal, or is it because he's like half Atlantean?
I think always because in the 70s or 80s, they're like, well, this guy's supposed to have been in World War II. Let's just say that Atlanteans live a long time.
Yeah.
I don't think like in the 40s comics that he was in that probably ever came up. He was just a strong guy from the sea.
Right.
But I think as the farther World War II got out from whatever the present was, the more they needed to come up with a reason for him to still be kicking with all this.
Yeah, makes sense.
But yeah, they're all alive in the present time, and it seems like in something that normally sounds like a really bad cliche, Namor is like, considering the sort of a war on the surface world and is trying to consolidate various powers beneath the sea. The way they do it is really interesting. The structure of this kind of hooked me. This starts with, and so in other words, the invaders are going to end up having to fight one of their own. That's the baseline premise of this. But what this starts with is this kind of grueling scene where he's like near the end of the war trying to save an injured guy like an American soldier. And he keeps taking, like, hits and shells, and they mentioned that he's been out of the water for a long time, which that was a thing for him. Like, he'd become super dehydrated. He could die if he was out for too long.
Right.
Right.
And, like, you know, he's just getting shot to pieces here, and it seems like the battle ends up won, but, I think they're setting him up to have a lot of, like, PTSD. Sort of thing, and that will be maybe that combined with could be weird surface world aquatic world stuff that like sets him off on these kind of like almost like, you know, that maybe his rages and all that stuff, his destroy the surface world, is some kind of a byproduct of that. But we'll see. That's not definitive in this one. And the other kind of framing story is that the guy, the Human Torch guy, what's his name? Hammond?
Jim Hammond.
Yeah, Jim Hammond, is looking to write a book that's kind of a personal book about his time with the invaders. And so you see, you know, he's getting recollections from Cap and other people. So you see some of these flashbacks to immediately after the war where Namor is like, sort of post-war is like, it looks like he's trying to like hook up with like a prostitute or something, or at least a French woman. And Cap is like, hey, you know, I don't think you processed that guy that GI that you're really close to is dead. And Namor is like, get out of my face. And Cap kind of gets in his face. He's like, you need to show up at his memorial and you need to deal with that. And it does seem like he's correct. Like Namor grudgingly shows up, and it's kind of interesting to see when you see the funeral the next day. Like, Namor's in fatigues and stuff like that. Like, he's wearing his own army uniform thing that he has just for the formality of the service.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of sort of serious stuff like that. This feels like akin to Ed Brubaker's Captain America run that took it as sort of, like, played with the military, I guess, side.
That makes a lot of sense.
Of Cap's life and these other heroes. But anyway, I found it all pretty compelling, and I liked that. Way back when I was a kid, Randy, you've read these issues, Roger Stern's Avengers. Namor joined the Avengers during that.
Yeah,
people were like, there were protests. I don't mean real-life reader protests. I mean in the comic, people were saying, Namor has made war on the surface world, and Cap kind of stands up for him and does this thing where he's like, no, I fought alongside this guy. He's had his issues. He's tried to, you know, make amends, and this is another way of him making amends, and I stand by him. And this felt like of a piece with that. This felt like that the Namor, even though there is a plot that is involving him doing sort of a surface world attack, I think that it is going to be ultimately about kind of a nuanced look at him where he is not a straight villain. He's not a madman who just suddenly attacks the surface world randomly. That is going to have a reason. In his weird way, it might even be a little bit like a different aspect of the Nick, what's the DC thing, the Heroes in Crisis?
Yeah, Heroes in Crisis,
which is also dealing with some of those issues of post-traumatic stress. And then there's even a third plot. You see Namor gathering forces, and he has seems to have some new abilities to manipulate water, whether it's him or magic.
Yeah, I was wondering that seems to be a notable thing.
Yeah, he goes and he like reins in this kind of What were they? Like, they were separatist, yeah, Atlantean, like...
something. I've seen something of V. I've seen them in the comics before.
Okay, yeah, I don't know much about them. I wasn't sure if they were invented for this or not. But it's like this separatist group that's like kind of a militant group that he wanted to bring under his sway. And he shows them just how much power he's got, and they reluctantly join up. Anyway, so there's like flashbacks to World War II, sort of secret history being revealed in the present as the book is being researched, and then there's the Namor gathering his forces plot. I ended up liking all three of them, and, you know, Hammond, it was like, is a character I don't particularly know much about, but I liked how he was portrayed here, and I'm kind of hoping this ultimately does end with all of them, you know, back somehow on the same page, and, yeah, you know, smashing modern-day Nazis in the face. But right now, there's a lot of personal drama in it, and I was way into it. Oh, it also has super nice art from Butch Geis, who...
Oh, yeah. I know this was Butch Geis.
He working in conjunction with somebody. So Carlos Magno with Butch Geis. Okay. So maybe he did the... one of them did, like, the layouts, but you can see that it looks a bit like Brubaker's Cap Run.
There's two different artists. I mean, Butch Geis does flashbacks.
Yeah, that's right. It's like... I take that back. Yeah, it's all Butch Geis in there. It's the Atlantean stuff in the present where Namor is gathering his forces. And he looks a little like Aaron Cooter's artwork. Not great. A little bit more realistic than that, but it's sort of a piece with that. Anyway, I had no expectations of this. I have no particular fandom for the Invaders, although I like a good World War II superhero story. But I'm very on board this.
I have an important question for you.
Yeah.
Does he say Imperius Rex in it?
Yes.
He does.
Oh, that's good. That makes me happy. I feel like you can't use Namor without him saying that.
Yeah. I forget if it's in a... Is it in a World War II flashback?
I would hope so.
Or is it when he is wrecking Atlantean stuff? I can't remember, but Nick, you tell me what your pick is, and I will remind myself.
I want to talk about the super happy book that is The Batman Who Laughs. And this is issue number 2. However, this is not a happy book. This is, in fact, one of the darkest stories that I think DC is doing right now, which is weird because I'm not really in the mood for dark stuff, but it's, I think, in the execution of it, Scott Snyder and artist Jock are just really good at what they do. I mean, they were the minds behind, I think, Brandy's one of his more favorite Batman stories, The Black Mirror, of recent days. And this one, I think Snyder is relishing in the fact that his villains are so villainous and the Batman is on the ropes, like literally dying. He's like a week's away from dying and turning into...
They're going to kill Batman?
Turning into kind of the Joker.
Right.
But Snyder still has Batman doing some cool stuff. Very cool, like, undercover investigative work. Disguising himself as Harvey Bullock. There's some great stuff.
I'm picturing Harvey Bullock like just Batman with like a fat suit and a trench coat on.
Yeah.
Like with the ears and everything.
But Snyder's also building up sort of more Gotham mythology and things like that. And then, of course, there's the Batman Who Laughs, who's just scary. And he's like utilizing this weird story about killing other Bruce Waynes from other like parallel universes. But it's all sort of in service to a larger plot that he has going. And it's violent, and this also continues the introduction of the Grim Knight, which is essentially Bruce Wayne as the Punisher.
Yep.
And is, like, even worse than the Punisher ever could be.
is he worse than the Batman movie where he brands people?
Yes. Okay. He's like, insane.
He's a bad man.
So, is he from another world?
He was basically a trump card that the Batman Who Laughs had in his pocket that he never used during Metal. He had brought him over during that and never used him.
All right.
Yep. So, he's basically a holdout. And it's terrifying. Jock does an amazing job. There's some action sequences in here that are beautiful. And violent, and I don't know, it's not really what I was expecting that I wanted, but it's very good at what it does, and that's Snyder kind of in a nutshell. He has sort of made his indelible mark on Batman over the years, and this is him just kind of cutting loose. My backup pick is the complete opposite of that, and then it's Ironheart number 2, which is about a young hero trying to find her footing, also dealing with a lot of her own kind of inner demons, the way sort of like Namor, you were talking about PTSD. She has got some of that as well, with dealing with like her best friend being killed, trying to become a hero.
That's a very... These are pretty classic Marvel tropes, although the... Starting out, like even Peter didn't have, like, a lose anybody too early on. Gwen Stacy was years and years into the run.
Yeah, and Riri Williams is a very interesting character. She's not like a lot of the heroes I can think of.
Uh-huh.
I mean, she's got aspects of it, like the smarts and her but... her demeanor and kind of the way she interacts with people is very different. It's not kind of out in the open. It's not... She's very closed off in a lot of respects. Mm. The only thing she really opens up to are sort of her family and her AI, which is now mapped off of the person who died.
Oh, weird.
Her best friend. Which is kind of bizarre, but it's a way of sort of...
That's
how
some Black Mirror disturbingness.
It is, but it works. But they're also sort of the classic Marvel superhero stuff of her just fighting, villains and...
Was her best friend a guy or a girl?
Girl.
And also, I don't know if she's if she's straight, gay, or any of the above. But
her sexuality is not...
Basically, what I was wondering is, is she talking to somebody who she ever had romantic inclinations
to?
They were like best friends. It'd be like Genki being Peter's AI.
Yes. Yeah, okay. Yeah. But it's also sort of flashback to her as in high school, but she's like a 10-year-old because she was that smart.
Right.
And I like what Evel Ewing is doing with... I don't know her as a writer, but I think she's doing a really good mark on her in the same way that like Saladin Ahmed is doing with Miles Morales.
Uh-huh.
This feels very much a piece to it. Kind of traditional superheroes, but with its own kind of spin.
Would a kid like it?
I think so, very much, actually.
You know, like a 10 or 12-year-old or whatever.
Yeah,
you know.
And Luciano Vecchio is really kind of selling the artwork. It's kind of got this energetic feel.
Yeah, I like it as I'm looking.
I also really like her.
Character designs and all seem very varied and unique.
Yeah, and, you know, Alchemex is... They're using the Marvel Universe because Alchemex is involved and things like that. I also really like her suit. I know a lot of people were kind of... ragging on a bit because it's pink and has a heart on it, but that's sort of indelible to her character because that's what she wants people to remember of her for her heart, and I like that. It's different from like other superheroes that we've seen. So I don't know. I'm really enjoying this series. It's been very fun.
Dave, your backup.
My backup pick is Venom number 10.
What?
You're a Venom lover.
I'm a Venom lover. I'm a Marvel lover this week, too.
You love his tongue.
And a lover of dark stories this week, apparently.
Yeah.
I read the trade recently and really liked it, from Don and Cates, the first trade. But until that second trade comes out, I'm several issues behind. But I decided I would just read this randomly and just see what's going on, even though I'm essentially skipping over probably about 4 or 5 issues.
Yeah.
It seemed fairly standalone. What largely this issue is based around is a conversation between Eddie Brock and his someone they say claiming, and this is in the previously on portion of it, they said claiming to be his half brother Dylan Brock. So there is this question of the symbiote has lost its personality and voice right now. They describe it as an amorphous alien organism that responds to the subconscious impulses of its host, Eddie Brock, but it is no longer talking to him and communicating with him.
There was a big moment that happened in one of the issues that sort of was a game changer for that.
And so I think they wanted to, it's actually, as a story arc, it makes a lot of sense. It's like these two personalities have relied on each other a lot. What happens if they can't?
Right.
So that's what this second arc seems to be about. But in this issue, he's like at a diner. Having burgers and fries with this potentially his half brother. By the way, there's some question about possible memory issues. It says the creature has been tampering with Eddie's memories. So whether all of this is believable or not, I don't know. But a lot is made of it in this course of the story. So I think the main stuff we're seeing here is real. Anyway, his the conversation with his half-brother, who's a kid who looks like he's about, I don't know, 12, 13, 14, something like that, has a black eye from their abusive dad. And they have a kind of conversation where they... Like the kid had started out saying, like, hey, could you kill Dad or whatever? And, like, they'll come around, they come back around to that. But it's, like, pretty serious stuff. And he's, like, but he's also kind of juxtaposing it with, like, but I also heard you're a good guy. And, but my friend said that Spider-Man's a better hero because he has, like, a real moral code and you kind of don't. But, so there's some interesting questions about sort of Venom as a concept in here. And I think Donny Cates is having a good time sort of responding to them.
Still Jeff Shaw on art.
No, it's actually.
Jeff Shaw actually hasn't done any of it. It's always been Ryan Stegman.
Yeah. All
right. Okay. Ryan Stegman.
Yeah. Stegman
the
doing
art is really nice.
It's really nice and really beautifully colored too. It has that sort of lush coloring to it.
Yeah.
What was it reminding me of? I'll see if I can think of it as I'm reading. This is mostly their conversation, and during the course of it, he asks. He said, like. The kid says, like, hey, but I know you protect innocence. Why do you have such a thing about protecting innocence? And he reveals something about his past that's new to the character's backstory. Mm-hmm. Now, this is one of those things that's, like, so kind of traumatic that it's, like, it could make some people pretty pissed, I think, about Eddie Brock. Like, this is if that happened, I don't know if I can like this character again. But the way it actually plays out, I can only say that the way Donny Cates writes it out has some depth, and I think they might change their mind by the end of it. And I went from kind of like being like, whoa, this is maybe a bridge too far, Donny Cates, to this kind of makes it works to kind of to create a psychological reason why he would do it and keep the character, keep his backstory dark because, you know, he's Venom.
Yeah.
Anyway, by the end of it, there is some action and craziness and symbiote stuff, but that is only kind of near the very end. It is primarily a conversation and a flashback story. Anyway, I was digging it, I will be interested to see if this is in fact canonical and sticks around. If you are kind of been curious about it, you might want to pick up the issue and just see what's going on.
So is this mid-story, or is this part of a...
It's clearly mid-story, but it was easy to walk in because it's literally... This is like the issue begins with them sitting down at the diner, and then that's most of the issue. So you'll get all the big stuff in the issue itself.
So I'm going to talk about Black Widow.
Okay.
There's a new Black Widow number one, and we were talking... earlier on today, we were talking about Black Widow being as a solo character, maybe a hard sell. Like, Mark Waid and Chris Samnee did a run that I thought I was going to love, and it turned out I sort of drifted off on after really liking the first few issues.
I think we've always liked her as a supporting character in the Avengers or Daredevil or other places. But solo character is tougher.
Yeah. So this is written by Jen and Sylvia Soska. I don't know who that is. New people. Artist is Flaviano, who I'm trying to remember what I've seen him in. And I think he worked on America, Power Man and Iron Fist, Spider-Man, Deadpool. I'm trying to think what all I've seen him on. I feel like he worked on more DC stuff. But it's I really like the art. The art is really pretty. It's got a, I'd say almost a manga style in some ways.
Yeah.
It's got really great action. The colors by Veronica Gandini are really, really nice. They really pop. And this basically starts on New Year's Eve as Black Widow, still believed dead by most people because she was killed by Secret Empire's Cap.
Yep.
She is now like a black op again, but she's working with Steve Rogers because there is a someone impersonating Steve Rogers, and he is not happy about this given what happened to him.
Right. It's like ever since the events of what was it called, Secret Empire?
Yeah.
Where you win like evil Hydra Nazi Cap kind of took over the world.
Yeah.
Like it's emboldened other people to say, I'm Cap too, and like kind of try to blur his reputation. And
so they're at this party where a fake Cap is maybe trying to start some trouble. There's some funny stuff about it. It's pretty funny that, like, Cap is doing this bit about, how can you guys not know this isn't me? And people are like, I don't know, I thought he was making a lot of sense.
Right, right.
At one point, his allies start shooting. It's like, destroy the Star-Spangled Liar. Yes, destroy him, my Amerabots. And Cap's like, oh, come on. And right. Some guy in the crowd is like, yeah, get that Pinko Faker, robots.
Yep.
It was funny bits. But as Dave and I talked about off mic, it almost feels like a Cap story. The villain even uses the Mad Bomb, which is a classic Cap story.
Right.
But it's because it reminds me of the opening of like Winter Soldier, where Cap and Black Widow are working together, and I think that might have been what they're riffing on. Because Black Widow is off dealing with the goons and the robots, and then she winds up having a throwdown with the fake Cap. And that all seems to be the setup. It's like it's a great setup with her working with Cap. And then the last, I don't know, third of the book, maybe a little less, sees her basically deciding she's like, I can't be an Avenger anymore. She's like, I need to go be a spy, and I need to unleash the darkness that's in me and that kind of thing. And so she
kind of thing you can feel after you've been killed.
Yeah. So she winds up in Madripoor, rocking a patch. And
is that just a thing there?
Well, she references Wolverine. She's friends with Wolverine.
Okay.
And she basically goes looking for trouble and looking for a job, and she finds it. And I'm very interested to see what they do with her in Madripoor, because I love Madripoor as a setting, and I like the idea of Black Widow as sort of a fixer, a Black Ops out in the cold spy, working in sort of a gray morality place like Madripoor, against the worst of the worst. And the bad guy they come up with is definitely the worst of the worst. I'm curious to see what this sort of, like, off-the-radar Black Widow looks like. It's a good, solid first issue. It's not amazing, but it's a good, solid first issue, and I want to know where that setup goes.
Fair enough.
Also on my list this week, Man Without Fear number 3, which is more of Daredevil trying to recover from his accident. This time the Defenders guest star. Hawkman number 8, which introduces the secret hero of Krypton, a.k.a. The Hawkman of Krypton, which is interesting. Fantastic Four number 6, which starts a new Fantastic Four arc featuring Doctor Doom and Galactus. There's a couple of one-shots from IDW, Ghostbusters 2020 and TMNT 2020, which is either 20 years in the past or 20 years in the future of those characters.
It is one-shots. The 20th anniversary of IDW, yeah.
And then there is a Black Hammer Director's Cut, which is literally the first issue in black and white, and then the script. And it is, if you're a process nerd, you're going to dig this. Like, the art looks really great in black and white.
Yep.
Black Hammer's one of our favorite series. So,
yeah, you really get a sense of how good Dean Ormston is and how strong his, like, panel layouts and stuff are when you see it in black and white.
And finally, I want to throw a shout-out to the Farmhand trade, which this has been Rob Guillory's follow-up to Chew, and it feels very much like Chew. It feels like, oh, okay, the Rob Guillory was much more influential on the voice of Chew than I maybe knew. And it's definitely worth a read. So, Dave, what else you got?
Just one or two things I wanted to mention. There's an Avatar miniseries, and in a rare case, this is not about Avatar The Last Airbender, but in fact, the Blue Avatar people from James Cameron.
Right.
Cameron's movie. I'm not as much an Avatar hater as some folks are. It's just sort of, it was a more uninspired Cameron than I would have liked. But this is like, I guess, you know, the romantic interest in the story, the alien chick.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, she had like a sort of proud warrior who was courting her, who kind of got rebuffed in the course of it.
Yeah.
This is his story.
Ah.
I haven't read it all, but it's like, yeah, if you had some interest in the movie, if you like the blue cat people running around and fighting on an alien world, this might be up your alley.
Someone must.
Then lastly, I wanted to mention the reprint Marvel just put out of The Death of Captain Marvel. That is not the Captain Marvel, that is Carol Danvers,
right.
But the original one, the what's his name?
Marvel.
Yeah,
Genis Fell was his son.
Right. Yeah. This was, I believe, Marvel's first graphic novel.
It was their first graphic novel and dealt with Marvel dying of cancer.
Yeah, yeah. It was something that was kind of, it was written and drawn by Jim Shooter and it has
Jim Starlin,
thank you. His, really pretty rockin' artwork that, like, captures exactly how Marvel looked in, say, 1981,
yeah,
I think, or
yeah,
right around there is sure when it happened. And also a pretty serious topic as the heroes who had, like, fought alongside him kind of gather and reflect on it as he approaches death.
It was in a way, it was this crossover of its time. This was before Secret Wars and all this stuff. And
yep.
You
really saw everybody in the same place.
Yeah.
This new version I'm kind of tempted by, even though I have a reprint of the graphic novel,
right?
Because it also includes some key issues that sort of led up to it from the, like, his early appearances, so that you have a sense, I think, when you get to the death of who he was in his life, too.
Yeah.
So it seems pretty cool. I think it's probably Starlin stuff.
Yeah.
Or no, I see Roy Thomas in there, too, so, and Steve Englehart.
I was going to say, it's got some amazing... this one has some great art, looking at art by Gene Colan.
Doug Munch, Gene Colan, and Pat Broderick. Some of their really greats of the 70s.
I also want to say that, I mean, Starlin has a great career, but I still think this is his best drawn stuff.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. His art is really top-notch on this.
He had a lot more time to work on it, that's because it was the original graphic novel.
Yeah, it was. I mean, he was great in, like, Infinity Gauntlet and
Right. Although
he didn't draw Infinity Gauntlet.
Yeah. He's been drawing some of the specials, the Thanos specials in recent years.
Yeah.
And he's a super talented artist. But yeah, I agree with you, Nick. I think this, like, in the same way, I doubt from the third or fourth graphic novel Marvel did, God Loves, Man Kills. Mm-hmm. The artist was
Brent Anderson,
best known for Astro City. But to me, that's probably the best thing he'll ever draw.
Right.
Like, yeah. It's just so good.
Yeah. Even though Astro City's amazing.
Yep. Nick, anything else to mention?
Yes, I've got a few. Supergirl number 26, which sort of continues her trials of figuring out who was responsible for the death of Krypton. Some cool stuff. There's a great guest appearance by a fun intergalactic DC team that I thought was fantastic. I don't know. This is one of those series that I'm just enjoying. I think it's got great artwork, but Mark Andrako's done such a fun story with it, too.
Uh-huh. I forgot it was Andrako.
Yeah. Speaking of Superman, Superman number 7, the cover boasts what happened to Superboy's lost years, and Bendis finally reveals what happened to Jonathan Kent and Lois when they got in.
They went off with Jor-El?
Yeah, Jor-El.
Jor-El's European vacation?
Yes, Jor-El's European vacation. I expected to hate it. I actually thought there was some pretty fun stuff in here. I thought the artwork by Ivan Reis was amazing. And there's also a guest appearance from everyone's favorite bounty hunter. So I thought there was a...
Boba Fett,
indeed.
Jack Walsh from Midnight Run?
The man with no name.
So keep guessing. But I thought it was a strong issue, and I'm glad that Bendis didn't just outright like kill Jonathan Kent or didn't want to write him anymore. Then there was Marvel Comics Presents, which is a trio of stories kind of written by some pretty top-notch Marvel writers and artists. I mean...
It's like a new anthology series.
Yeah, the first story is by Charles Soule and Paul Sequeira. The second one is Greg Pak, and I can't remember who does the artwork.
Tom Coker.
When did Marvel Comics Presents originally run? The late 80s?
In the early 90s.
Okay.
And the second story is Namor, and then the third story is Andacenti and Greg Land, which I have to say, Greg Land's artwork in here is... I'd have to say stellar.
It's the best he's done in a long time.
Yeah, and like as a Captain America.
Whoever drew the Namor story.
Tom Coker.
Tom Coker.
Oh, Tom Coker.
Great.
Oh, that was who that was.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is, as you noted, Nick, a very dark story about the kind of some of the real aspects of World War II, but specifically how they relate to Namor. It's funny because it's not meant to, I think, tie in with the New Invaders book. But it kind of could.
I was going
to
say, it feels like, and I don't know if this was on purpose or just one of those happy accidents, but it does feel like a builds on what the Invaders does.
Exactly. Yeah. But, I mean, I was a big fan of Marvel Comics Presents, so I kind of like that it's back.
Well, because the Wolverine story also takes place in World War II.
It does.
Yeah, they were meaning to, I think, call back their first decade of history, even though, like, Wolverine was not created in the literal first decade of Marvel, but he's been essentially retconned in there, so it makes sense into him to have him in there.
Yeah. The seventh issue of Catwoman, which is the start of a two-issue story arc called Something Smells Fishy, which I thought was a fun title. But some beautiful artwork in here by Elena Casagrande and Fernando Blanco.
Oh, so Joelle Jones is not drawing anymore?
She's not. She's actually just writing it. And it's some dark stuff, but this is her versus the Penguin, which is great. And then one of my favorite books, Black Badge, gets its sixth issue, and sort of the mysteries of Black Badge continues. And yes, it is amazing.
Right, what's going to be in the first trade? 1 through 5? 1 through 6?
I would assume it'd be 1 through 6.
Or is it like going to be like, if this doesn't have an ending though, or like a kind of an obvious breakpoint, then is it going to be like a 12 issue
maybe
first volume?
So I mean, I don't know. I honestly think you could do 1 through 6 and it would feel...
Tell me what the format's going to be, Nick.
I don't know. You have to ask Matt Kent that.
Two more things that I thought one of you guys would mention, but I'll just throw in. Return of Wolverine number 4 comes out this week. And Firefly number 3, for people who have been reading those.
Yep.
Alright, so we'll be back in just a second. We're going to talk about a TV show on Netflix that Nick and I have watched.
Talking about comics, movies, and fame. They even talk about board games. No week is the same.
Alright, real quick, Nick and I want to talk about a show on Netflix that is on. It's called Sex Education. It was, it's...
There's a great trailer that made me want to see it, I just didn't have time to.
I think it's one of these co-productions between DBC and Netflix. They're saying it's an original, but I'm pretty sure it was like a British show that they grabbed.
Another one of those?
Yeah. It's 8 episodes. Creator is Lori Nunn.
Yeah, I was looking to see what else she had done.
And I was also looking to see what else she'd done, and I don't
Can I say what the premise is based on what I think the trailer showed?
Sure.
This teenage kid has a mom who's a notable sex therapist.
Yes.
And like a well-known sort of celebrity sex therapist. Yep. And the kids at school get the notion that he can, from whatever he's picked up from her or by osmosis or whatever, he can become the sex therapist for the kids having teen sex at the school.
Yes and no. Yes. So, Gillian Anderson plays the sex therapist.
Uh-huh. And she's amazing.
And she's great. She has sort of boundary issues, and she's divorced and is having trouble writing. She's got her own arc as well.
Yes.
Ozzie Butterfield plays Otis, who is her son. And there's a girl named Maeve, who is sort of a... She's like the punk girl.
Yeah, she's the on the fringe of everybody. But a lot of kids think she's the cool one.
Okay.
Yeah.
So she basically... There's this bully kid named Adam who is the son of the headmaster,
uh-huh.
And he's having some problems with his girlfriend, and something happens where he needs help, and even though he's bullied Otis's friend, Otis winds up in this sort of place where Maeve is there too, where he kind of helps talk this kid down using this language he's picked up from his mom.
Okay.
And so Maeve is like, yeah, that was amazing. We could do this. You can be a sex therapist, and I'll deal with the money and the bookings, and you deal with the talk.
Uh-huh.
And that's how it all comes
okay.
about.
Okay,
yeah.
And there's also a relationship between him and Maeve. Maeve has her own relationship with the head boy, who is a swimmer.
Yep.
His gay best friend
head
is...
Boy?
Head boy's a thing.
There's a lot of British
Okay. Just checking.
British. There's several other characters. Each episode starts with a pair of teenagers essentially having sex and having problems with sex, and then we see that develop through the episode, as well as like an ongoing story about these major teen characters.
I mean, it's like the reverse of like Supernatural or Bones or anything, where we get a murder, and this one we get a sex scene, and there's something going wrong in the sex scene, and that's sort of addressed.
And that's the episode. That's the story of the week. But the most story is the overarching story about Otis being a virgin and deciding what he wants out of sex, and his mom deciding what she wants out of life, and Maeve and Eric and all the other characters.
Yeah, but it's also very kind of sex positive in a lot of ways, and I really appreciated that.
Anything that's it sounded risky to me to like have a story that's about teen sex. You know,
it's also very funny.
Yeah, the trailers looked it from what I saw,
yeah.
But like that's a dangerous thing. Like. Let alone just the fact that you might be depicting it in any way is like, is that going to be lurid? Is it going to be exploitational?
This is why it's British,
uh-huh.
Not American.
Yeah, where Americans don't have the same sort of,
it has different hang-ups.
The taboos and stuff are different, yeah.
And British are kind of, they are sex positive in a lot of ways, and I honestly think the stories here are fantastic, and they're just fun.
Nick, have you watched all of this?
I am, I think... An episode. I'm on episode 7.
Okay, and I've seen 4 of them, and I'm really liking it. I'm definitely going to try and finish up the rest of it this week. But
who do you think could teenagers watch this show?
No, probably not.
Probably not. I mean, it is definitely kind of. I mean,
older teens.
Maybe.
Yeah. I mean, there's nothing.
That's what I was wondering. Is like, was it targeting them, or at least partially? Because obviously, it's targeting adults as well. But
I don't think it is. I think this is. I mean, I'll say this. The bullying, the
there
social
literally is a bullying where he's after lunch money, which I thought was amusing.
Yeah, but I bought that one. The social interaction, all this kind of stuff, feels very real, feels very teenage.
Well,
okay,
but
going back to that, it's like none of the characters are very one dimensional. They are very well rounded. Even the kid who is the bully, they spend more time with, and you get to see why he is the way he is.
Oh yeah, they flesh him out quite a bit. Yeah,
which they do for all the characters, and I really like that about the show.
Mm-hmm.
But as to whether or not teens could watch this, yes, they could. But I mean,
well, I would even think it would potentially be one where they should, because like something that might kind of help shepherd them through the awkwardness of that, and maybe in some of the moral quandaries.
I think you'd need the distance. You need the distance to have had been. You want to have been a teen, but not be a teen while you're watching this. I feel like it's not gonna resonate as well.
What if somebody watches it but they haven't been a teen before?
Well, that'd be harder.
what if Benjamin Button watched it?
Yes, if Benjamin Button watched it, he would probably not enjoy it. I do think this is mostly made for adults who remember their teenage years and not for teenagers.
Right.
But It's really funny. It's really well done. I'm very much looking forward to watching the rest of it.
And my wife was like, is that Dana Scully from X-Files? Yeah. Like, yes, it is.
Yeah,
and
she's amazing. She's great in this. Yeah. All right, that's it for us for the week. We'll be back next time. And until that time,
yo, Joe.
Thanks for listening. If you like the show, do us a favor and spread the word to your friends. Or give us a quick 5-star rating and review on iTunes to help us grow our audience. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or at www.roguesgallerytx.com. We'll be back next week.